This episode is sponsored by a company I've literally been using for over 15 years now, and that is 5.11. Now, my introduction to their products began when I started wearing 5.11 uniforms years ago for Anaheim Fire Department. And since then, I have acquired a host of their backpacks and luggage, which have literally been around the world with me. The backpack where I keep all my recording equipment is a 5.11 backpack. And then most of my civilian gear, the clothes that I wear, are also 5.11. Now, more recently, they've actually branched out into the brick and mortar stores. So, for example, Gainesville, where I do jiu-jitsu, has a beautiful 5.11 store. So if you are a fire department, a law enforcement agency, you now have access to an entire inventory of clothing and equipment in these 5.11 stores. Now, I've talked about the range of shoes they have and how important minimizing weight in our footwear is when it comes to our back health, knee health, etc. I've talked about their unique uniforms that are fitted for either male or female first responders. And then I want to highlight one new area, their CloudStrike packs. For those of you who enjoy hiking, this would even be an application, I believe, for the wildland community. They've created an ultralight pack now with a hydration system built in for rucking, running, or other long-distance events. Now, as always, 5.11 is offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, 15% off every purchase that you make. So if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, at 511tactical.com, you will get that 15% off every single time. So if you want to hear more about 5.11 and their origin story, go to episode 338 of Behind the Shield podcast with their CEO, Francisco Morales. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show comedian and firefighter spouse, Rachel Feinstein. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from her early life, her journey into comedy, the observations she first had dating a firefighter, how that material is infused into her latest Netflix special, Big Guy, and so much more. Now, I do want to say that we were having some technical difficulties and there is distortion on Rachel's mic, but I managed to clean it up and I hope it's not distracting to this interview. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 900 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Rachel Feinstein. Enjoy. Well, Rachel, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to come on the Behind the Shield podcast. I know we've been mitigating some gremlins in the works this morning.
Yes, lots going on.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
I am in my home in Queens, in New York.
So I would love to start at the very beginning of your journey. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
I was born in Washington, D.C., and my dad was a federal prosecutor for the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department. So he used to prosecute KKK cases and stuff like that. And then he was also a blues musician. So he plays piano, zydeco, accordion. My mom is a social worker and therapist. And now she's retired and she's here helping me get through this crazy week with a toddler.
Now, what sent your dad into the civil rights side of law rather than some of the, you know, more profitable areas that might drag a lawyer that direction?
I think he wanted to be a musician. He is a brilliant musician. He can play anything by ear and he's very bright. He skipped two grades in school My mom said he never really studied much, but did well. But he wanted to be a musician. And in his family, you know, they grew up pretty poor, his father. And it was like, you got to be a doctor or a lawyer. So, like, they basically gave him that choice. And I think that he thought, well, if I'm a lawyer, then I'd like to do something that I, you know, that's helpful, that I could believe in. And he met my mom at, you know, UCSB, and my grandfather, I think he was in the Navy, and they moved from Queens to Palo Alto when he was a kid. And they were, you know, they were a working class family that was trying to get to that next level. So they were like, Howie, piano player ain't going to cut it. So I think they probably would have preferred that he was a more profitable lawyer. And then he ended up, after prosecuting for several years out of the Justice Department, he had three kids. There was a lot of pressure to, you know, make ends meet. And he tried to get into like a private practice job, which he hated. He couldn't do the schmoozing thing. He really couldn't even do it. Like, he's just, you know, he's a weird guy that like flicks his head, that has strange tics, that's like brilliant, but not like a schmoozer at all. And they have stories about him in the Justice Department where he was like roasted for wearing two different shoes to a trial. And apparently his co-counsel was like, hey, Howie, those are two different shoes. And he was like, hey, thanks for letting me know about that. I'll make sure it won't happen again. And apparently he came back the next day with the same pair of mismatched loafers. So he was not cut out for private practice and got laid off. And then that was when I was babysitting in seventh grade. So there were three kids. My mom's a social worker. And he, you know, was kind of just trying to play piano at Nordstrom or wherever to figure it all out. So, but he's still playing piano, and I think he's happiest doing that. So that's cool.
What about from the social work side for your mom? And obviously you talk about your mom quite a bit in your comedy, but what have you seen as far as the intersection of her work and maybe even some of the mental health conversations you've heard from your husband?
My husband bringing up mental health.
Or not. I mean, either way, the abstinence of conversation may also...
I don't think she has exposure to the first responder side, but she did work with more of an adult population trying to intervene before they became homeless and try to help families that and victims of domestic violence and try to help the kind of families in crisis and prevent them from becoming homeless. So they sort of offered a variety of services. She started doing therapy, but that she, for most of my childhood, directed this clinic that kind of ran this shoestring budget, but she got a lot of, she basically set up a series of different programs within her clinic and worked with other DC associations to do stuff like fatherhood initiatives to get fathers who were let out of jail back in touch with their families and different services to help victims of domestic violence find their way and get some help repairing their family and preventing them from becoming homeless. So she did a lot of amazing things. They just recently gave her like a Lifetime Achievement Award, and it was very sweet. And all these different people came out and said how she changed their lives, and all these kids that were benefits of different scholarship program that she started. And it was cool to see a lot of people turn their lives around and use those services. Like, she was good at figuring out what would kind of put people in charge of themselves and figure out what they needed. And it was very, she's very successful. She's got two different Lifetime Achievement things. She did a lot of stuff, and she was always like, wouldn't give herself a raise. And, you know, we drive the same old used Datsun. But now she's here relaxing in Queens. I just got her a manicure. So she's happy. She's just telling me to put on powder.
Well, when I speak to a lot of the comedians that have come on this show, it's an interesting conversation because more often than not, there was an element of comedy in their earlier life. And I remember being, I was tiny as a little boy. I had like a blonde afro, buck teeth. I mean, you know, real looker and dry skin to add to it. And so when I look back, comedy was definitely one of my coping mechanisms or defense mechanisms in a positive way. You know, it wasn't self-deprecating to a detrimental point. When you look back now at your formative years, are there any elements you think that contributed to your journey into comedy?
It's hard to know the one thing that did it, but I definitely was a wild moron in school, just got terrible grades. School moron, not a regular moron, just, you know, school moron. And so I was sort of failing everything and kind of just a real train wreck. I always kind of was like just shedding my things and could never find my papers or whatever I needed for school. And my backpack was always a wild disaster. And I was just getting D's and F's and always being scanned or like at some kind of speech therapy. I got everything like in school, everything a public school can offer in elementary school. I already had to like figure out what in God's name is wrong. We have to just get this girl just streamlined in the system. And it just wasn't working. So I was like doing voices and imitating people and trying to get attention that way. And probably trying to be liked that way and be like, hey, I might be failing, but I can write a fun, loving note on the bottom of my test that you just failed me on, like telling you a short story or something. So I was always kind of trying to distract people from whatever they actually wanted me to do with, you know, wacky voices. Why not?
So when you think about the traditional education system and how many kids don't actually thrive in that environment, do you think that you, if it had been a different kind of philosophy, you know, you have trade schools versus colleges, for example, that maybe a different type of school would have been a better fit?
Definitely. And eventually, by the time I was a junior in high school, they were like, she's not going to graduate. So they ended up getting into a tiny Quaker school. And it was a program for kids that were, it was kind of like a juvie. It was like, it wasn't like a juvie for like, there's no room for the violent kids. It was just the kids that were failing. So I thought I got in the program and I was later told that it wasn't like a getting in kind of thing. It was like a last resort school. But I went to my last resort school and then that I got a small learning environment, like 7 or 8 kids. It was a tiny little Quaker school in Silver Spring, Maryland. And it was like 7 or 8 or 10 kids in a class. We called our teachers like Doug and Jane, and I learned things because I had conversations and I like actually began to absorb information and people would talk to me through stories. And I never went to college. So I definitely believe in trade schools and like getting people just getting working at what compels them the most and figuring that out early on. I have no idea how you accomplish that in a large public education system. But I think that I like that idea and that maybe colleges will slowly be phased out, except for the people that really need them for specific reasons, but just to like kind of go in a real environment and learn what compels you. That's the only thing that kept me attentive.
Yeah. I think it's a massive part of the conversation. I've got my son and my stepson, he just turned 23 today. My stepson hated school. He was very bright. Like he's the kind of annoying kid that could take the test at the end of the year and still get an A. I don't know how he did. It defies math, but he ended up becoming a mechanic and he absolutely loves it.
Yeah,
my youngest now going through the pipeline and wants to be a veterinary surgeon. And, you know, whether he does or not, that's the academic route for him. So, you know, there's all these different types of fit. And even with my youngest, it's the cool teachers that he really connects with, the ones that swear and tell stories and, you know, the real human
yes,
being.
I love that. Yeah, I always liked, when I watch TV, I like to watch like historical fiction because it's like the way I learn. I like stories that involve facts that are entertaining and colorful and like tell me about this period of history through a family and their family dynamics and their fights, like, you know, Peaky Blinders, like that's how I learn, you know. So and that's probably why I like theater and acting out, and like I just like to have some color. And that's probably why I remember there learned a little more from the teachers with like, you know, accents or weird affectations or just like something I could something I could like link my mind into, where I was like, that little weird affectation or something that I found compelling. But definitely I feel like now when I even go into a school, when I smell a school, it like brings me back to all those feelings. And I hope that it's changed enough so that my daughter has a really different experience and that she gets a little more of my husband's more mathematical type learn, just so that it's easier for her, you know, but we'll see. I don't know. She's kind of silly, but she likes large puzzles and she'll sit there and want to complete it. I could give a fuck about a puzzle. I never remember like looking at a puzzle and caring whether it was done or not. I'm like, who cares? Yeah. I get very bored by museums. You know, it seems like a graveyard for like compelling things, you know? So, I think, and I hope that like the education system, it's like less geared towards getting in specific colleges, which just seems like a big financial scam. In a way.
No, it does. You look at the prereqs, you know, my wife's just in optometry school now, which is an eye doctor, and she had to do all kinds of math classes. I'm like, where's the Rain Man shit in testing your eyes? Which is better, one or two? I get you got to have a certain level of math, but you don't need to be doing calculus to figure out getting a rocket into space.
Yeah, like so much unnecessary, really old school shit. Just these thick, densely boring books. Like I was just archaically bored in school, just profound levels of boredom. So I amused myself, talked a lot of shit, got in trouble, and failed until I went to a tiny school where we just had a chat about something, and that worked a little better for me.
Now, what about exercise and sports? What were you playing back then?
Oh, nothing. I never played sports. I really never did any extracurricular activities because I think that school early on affected my confidence a lot. So I don't think that I tried very hard. Plus my grades weren't very good. So a lot of times if you don't get a certain level of grades, they're not really considering that. I think I did a little bit of piano when I was really little but it was taught in a way that it was a little, again, too kind of linear by the book. It wasn't the way I learned. I kind of got bored by piano, or I wasn't doing my lessons. I wasn't following up. So they stopped doing that. And then I did take some acting classes, and that I enjoyed. But for the most part, I was just, you know, talking smack with my friends. I was not excelling in any department or area in my life until I later on moved to New York and started stand up and found what excited me.
Well, prior to that then, what were you dreaming of, any kind of career or profession when you were in the school age, or were you like a lot of 18-year-olds?
I think that I really loved Tracy Ullman, and I loved the voices that she did, and I loved when she would go outside. When I was a little girl, she would go outside at the end of her show, and she would go home, all of you, go home, and she would wear her robe, and so I used to wear my mom's robe and go out and do that, and be like, go home, and I love how she become all these different characters. Like, I thought she was the best. I still think she's absolutely amazing, brilliant. I love watching her in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Small Time Crooks, like anything Tracy Ullman does, I still want to see. And she was definitely the first woman that I saw when I was a little girl, and I was like, I want to do that. So that's what I wanted to do, some version of either, you know, doing characters. I didn't really know about stand-up. I wasn't one of these comics that watched stand-up religiously and only listened to comedy albums. I think I started like listening to maybe like Janine Garofalo in high school or Little Sarah Silverman, but I was never obsessively following like old stand-up albums. I didn't really know that you could do stand-up and tell stories. I figured that was like more for like a clever, quick monologue style joke writer, which was never what I did. I couldn't write those really quick kind of topical clean jokes. I admire that ability. I think it's very interesting, but I'm more of a storyteller. So it wasn't really until I started, after I moved to New York and started doing theater and acting and met a comedian that I was chatting with in a bar, who he was like, oh, you could do stand up. Yeah.
I remember watching Tracy Ullman when I was a kid, and I'm 50 now.
She's amazing.
What is it about her that has created such longevity in her career?
She's just so insanely talented. I mean, she played all these different voices and she did them so well. And she picked up on those little weird things that you wouldn't notice about somebody, something their eye does, a word choice. I love weird word choices. And strange affects, and she was warm. Like, she was silly. She wasn't like trying to make some sort of like, I don't know, pious political point. She was just, you know, taking the piss out of things, just being funny, being fun. That's like always how I got into it. Like, I don't want to teach anybody anything. I feel like you should always start with like, what's funny, what makes you laugh. And I feel like she just had that innate quality. And that's the kind of thing, like the stuff that would make you laugh when you were a kid, when you were sitting around with your friends and you didn't think you were smarter than anybody else. And I feel like that's what I try to stay in touch with the best I can doing stand up now.
I went to drama school years ago following a girl. She was in there doing the set design. And so I got into drama school. I don't know how, and spent a year realizing that I was probably one of the worst actors that had ever graced the planet Earth. But I found stunt work. I was very good at the physical side and swords and all that. And I ended up doing stunts alongside the fire service. Talk to me about your journey into drama school, and then how did you make that shift into comedy?
So I didn't do drama school. I had a private coach. I was working at a store on Broadway called Star Magic, and we sold like little rocks and stones and beads and things. And I was 19 or 20. Yeah, probably like 19. And I sold these little things. And then I made, I think, $5.25 an hour. Some lady came in, said she was in the play Grease and she needed something for her co-star, John Cicada. And I sold her a necklace, like a some kind of like cool chain for her co-star. She was very beautiful. This like pretty blonde lady, who, you know, she just like smelled like money and success. And I was like fascinated that she was just like, I'm an actress. I'm like, you can just say that. And that's just what you do. That's so cool, you know? And I was about to get fired from Star Magic. I had no idea. I was like, my goal was just to be not homeless, just to be homelish at best. And I always thought it was going to be some sort of Grey Garden situation for me. So I talked to her. She told me, I have this coach. Her name is Florence Winston. She's amazing. She teaches the great plays. She did a one-woman show on Broadway. It was called, like, Woman, a Theatrical Portrait or something. And so she's like, Florence teaches in her apartment on Riverside Drive. And it's up uptown. And you go there for 2 hours and you learn a piece of a play, a piece of work, and you study it together. You play a piece of jazz. You speak from the character's perspective, and then you go back to the script. And it's just very clean, nothing to do with the business, nothing to do with getting an agent. It's nothing commercial. She was like an old school, but hard ass, like you had to be there at 10 a.m., you know, 10 to 12. And she spent 2 hours. And she would wear this big like hat, and she would kind of look at you. And when you didn't do something, when you made a choice that she didn't like, she would go, that choice is vulgar. There's a vulgarity to it. Try again, make a more noble choice with the character, empathize with the character. And then she would, when she was, she would kind of glare. And then when she went like this, you were like, ah, I got her. She was like, everybody just wanted to make Florence like lift her eyes up like that. And like maybe lift up her weird hat that she wear, this like sort of strange hat or like a large cloak, and she'd be like, ah. So you were just trying to get that one expression from Florence. And she kind of taught me discipline. That was my college. I went there, listened to a piece of jazz. We tried to empathize with the character. We started with Shakespeare. I played Juliet, but then I liked the nurse character better. I liked the weird, heinous, affected character. So then I started playing the nurse and gravitated more towards the weird, ugly, you know, for a lack of a better word, just would have been considered heinous at that time characters. So we did that. And then I met this guy at a bar. We have little performances just with the Florence Winston troupe. And then I met this guy at a bar who was a comedian, and we were just laughing and joking at this bar. I don't think I was 21 yet when I met him. I was just like pretend, I had like a fake ID or something at this Irish bar on the Upper East Side. And I would just joke around and talk and hang there. And he told me I should do stand up. And then he said there was a room, like a bar where comics were performing. So I had my nanny job, and I was like terrified all day to do my 5 minutes at this bar. And then I went there, and I think I had like 4 Jack and Cokes, and I don't drink that much. So like, I was like violently drunk just because I was terrified. I went on stage. I don't even think I had the microphone pointed at my mouth. I was just kind of aimlessly rambling, but I was so excited afterwards. I found out that I did a pretty bad job, and I think they were pretty annoyed, and nobody could really hear me because the microphone wasn't pointed at my mouth. But I was like, I can't wait to do this again. And the girl that organized that room, her name was Karen Burgreen. She's a very funny comedian. And Karen said, well, there's this show at this place called Gotham Comedy Club, and you have to bring 3 people to perform, and you can go there at this time, and they want you to bring 3 paid audience members. They were called bringer shows. And so I did a lot of those, but I didn't have friends yet in New York. So what I would do is I would go to that bar. It's called Sam Beckett's. It's closed long ago. I would go to Sam Beckett's. I would ask everybody on the pool team at the bar. I'd be like, hey, I want to be a comedian, and will you come to my show? And beg. And I remember this one guy, Rufus, on the pool team, and he was so sweet. He was huge. He was like morbidly obese, but he loved pool, and he had this cane. And he's like, I'll be there, baby. I'll be there, baby. And he was always there. And he's the kind of, like, he was overweight, where it was like, I can't imagine how much effort it was for Rufus to get his ass downtown and go to, and step outside his comfort zone, because he liked that dim bar and he loved to play pool there, and come and, you know, do what he said he was going to do and support this kid in her dumb dream. But Rufus was there every time. Other people would be like, we'll see you there, we'll come. They wouldn't be there. And if you didn't have your 3 people, you couldn't go on. But Rufus was always there, and I always like want to thank him. I don't even know if he's alive anymore. I don't know his last name, but I always think about Rufus and how he was always there, and he was there nice and early, and he bought his 2 drinks, and he was just happy for me.
So what was the evolution then from, you know, kind of that first open night experience through to open mic experience through to, you know, developing the style of comedy that you ended up doing?
I think through the first open mic, I guess, was, I mean, it was many, many years of all sorts of different experiences. I would do a lot of open mics, weird situations. I performed at laundromats. I had a room. I had a show at this bar called Mr. Biggs. And Mr. Biggs was like this bar in Midtown. I don't even know if it's open anymore. Anyway, the guy gave me $75 and every Wednesday or something. And he's like, just put on a show at my bar, figure it all out. You get the mic, whatever. So I think I like borrowed a microphone from somebody and I paid the comics. I think I had like 10 comics or something. I paid everybody. I split it up between everybody and we would go on for our $5 or $10 or whatever it was. And we would do stand up, if you could call that. It was people in a bar that wanted to drink and they don't think they wanted to listen to us. And we would just stand on top of tables and like annoy them. And so I remember there was this one time this guy from New York One came in and he was drinking at the bar. And I was like, oh my God, that's Lewis Dodley from New York One. And I was just like trying to do like crowd work with him. And like, I was so excited it was him. And he was so annoyed. Like, he's just like, bitch, I just want to sit here and drink my whiskey and like drown. This is my little escape from like my life and my wife and my God knows whatever other things he needed to run away from, poor Lewis Dodley. And I still felt bad that I like was just sitting there bothering him. He was like, what's like, and I was like trying to work him at the bar. And I recently did this interview at New York One. I got to apologize to Lewis who didn't remember me at all. He's probably in a blackout, but yeah. So I was doing a lot of those strange things, anything I could. And then I met some comedians that let me open for them on the road, feature for them on the road. So when you feature on the road at that time, it was like, you know, you got to get yourself there. So usually you might make $600, but you spend it all on travel and your hotel. So I would go do all that, get my plane ticket, stay in pretty places that were actively dangerous, like just $46 Priceline hotels, and then try to use the rest for like food or whatever. And a couple of guys, John Heffron was one of them. He would buy my plane ticket sometimes so that I'd be able to make a tiny bit of money. And there were a couple different people like that that had me open. Bill Burr had me open a few times. Todd Barry had me open. So those people kind of gave me some of my first spots. And then I got on this show called Last Comic Standing. Oh, Jeff Ross saw me. He gave me my first spot at an actual comedy club that wasn't a bringer show, because they would sometimes have a famous comedian host the new talent night or whatever at this club called Caroline's that since closed. So Jeff Ross was hosting one night. I still remember my outfit. I had this crazy snakeskin pants. They looked so dumb. I had a weird snakeskin pants on. I would just like try to dress like, I don't know, whatever. I thought I was like looking like, I was trying to like copy like some sort of Eddie Murphy dangerous vibe, but it was also mixed with like some sort of, I don't know, whoring, some sort of like fun loving horror I was trying to look like that I probably saw on TV. Whatever. I wore the weirdest outfits. It was either like overalls or like snakeskin pants. Either I looked like a farmer or like a some sort of real estate agent in a porn. So I saw Jeff. Jeff watched my set. Jeff said, you're good. I'm going to call Gina at this other comedy club, which was in the West Village. I'm going to get you an audition. And he called this lady and she said, she put me up. She watched me. She was like, he was like, 8:00 Friday night, kid, be there. And I was there. And thank God I did well. And that was when I first got into a real comedy club. And then I got on Last Comic Standing, doing an open call audition for that. Probably the third time at audition, there was so much failing, just wild amounts of failure. So many times I was like weeping on the phone with my brother or my different friends. So I think it was the third time I auditioned for Last Comic Standing that I finally got on the show. Many times it was just, they didn't want anything to do with me. And then I would just do some street weeping, go back to my nanny job. But this time they wanted me on. I got on that show. I made it to the top five. I think I was in the, yeah, I was the last woman on the show that season, season 10 of Last Comic Standing. And that enabled me to quit my day job, which I really loved too, because I really loved that kid. We're still close with his family. So that was hard transition because I kind of felt responsible to him. He had autism. We were very close and I wanted to help him. And I was trying to teach him this sort of facilitated communication. So I stayed at that job very long, even into when I was still featuring a lot, because we had a real bond, and I related to him and his struggle kind of to learn in school. he was at our wedding. He gave a little speech. He since went to Harvard. He's really done amazing things in his life. He's very autistic. He has like the physical symptoms and the stimming, but he's very brilliant. So anyway, we stayed in touch with that kid. I did stand up on Last Comic Standing, and that enabled me to headline. I wasn't opening for guys on the road. I wasn't in as many weird seedy situations. Now it was like I was actually moving some tickets. So that was exciting. So that was when I started headlining. And then off the heels of that, I got my first, slowly, this all happened very slowly, but probably like another year or two, first half hour special on Comedy Central. And that's kind of, that was my first big thing on TV.
Going to the caring that you did, what are some of the biggest myths when it comes to autistic young boys and girls or men and women?
Well, what I was fascinated with Danny was that when I first came to the house, there was popcorn all over because he would just sort of travel around with his popcorn, clap a lot, jump, a lot of ticks, a lot of stimming, and he was nonverbal. But they would use all these picture books. He had very loving parents who would make these kind of books that were like menus of all these photographs and magazine pictures of things that he loved. So when he wanted something, he would bring over his cute little scrapbook. He's a beautiful kid, like flip through all the pages and point to the thing he wanted. So at this time, he'd been diagnosed early on. I took him around to a different therapist and stuff. And the parents were hopeful, but in over their head with like how exhausting and hard it all is, and a lot of sensory issues, a lot of meltdowns and stuff. But at this point, he was nonverbal when I started with him. And the best kind of scenario that was being explained to them, I think, was that, you know, he'd be able to kind of calm down some of his physical impulses and they get him into some kind of, I don't know, with a para or a teaching attendant, some kind of mainstream program. But then I came to learn a little bit more about these ideas of facilitated information and facilitated communication, where you use a communication device and you teach the kid to, by calming their body, sometimes even just holding their shoulders without leading them too much, teach them to kind of try to say what they're thinking. So it started out, what I started doing with him first was using flashcards. So I would ask him, point to the flashcard that you use to get information from, and it would be, he'll point a computer, and then it'd be like a more advanced question, like, hey, can you point to the flashcard of people that are arguing? It'd be like a bunch of different people in different situations. Tell me who looks sad. Tell me who looks hopeful. Complicated emotional expressions and things like that. And then it would be scenes, and he was just getting everything right very quickly. And I was like, he's really smart. I just have a feeling he's really smart. And then he would get up and he would walk to the trash can. And sometimes our goals would be very simple. So it was like trying to understand what he knows that he can't, you know, and then also trying to get him to complete small physical loops. So it'd be like, come to the trash can, throw this out, come back. I related to that because that's what happened to me at school. I would get to the trash can halfway through. He would stop and he would just do this. And he was stuck there. And I was always stuck there. So I related to that. So I feel like for me, I really related with and probably projected onto him so many things in my childhood where it was like, it was so hard for me to just sit still and finish something. Sometimes I get all the way up to the finish point and then I couldn't push through. So then we would do stuff like, oh, we would go to the trash can and back. And then I'm like, oh my God, he threw that out. He came back. I didn't help him. Then we would go to walks around the neighborhood and do all of these things. And we started with what he loves, right? Following his own impulses. He loved these fish in this lobby. So we go to the lobby fish. Then we go to this deli he liked and we would get a sprinkle cookie. We'd do all these different things he loved. And then I would just sit in the chair and say if he could do three things in a row. So throw this out, pick up your hamburger, have a bite, do this. Now, this is a million meltdowns in the middle. I'd been bit. I'd been hit. We'd had, you know, craziness had happened. But he got a little more in control of his own body. And he felt good about that. That helped him feel confident. Then we started doing stuff that his father learned about this woman. I can't remember her name, but she's an Indian lady who taught her son all these different things by kind of ripping up all these pieces of paper and giving them all these little choices. And she had a son that we consider very severely autistic. And she taught him to kind of read and communicate and write sentences. Then Danny started writing full sentences. So it could be a day of like, you're going to learn the word they. And then he started doing it on his own. All I had to do was sometimes hold his shoulders. Then I would pull my hands back and he was really actually typing. And that was like so exciting. Then he was able to say stuff like, something that bothered him. And I remember one time we watched this movie, Helen Keller movie. I can't remember what it's called, but there's a scene with Helen Keller and her teacher, Anne Sullivan, and Helen Keller is having a lot of difficulty learning something. Sitting at the table. She can't sit at the table. In the scene, the parents just let her walk all around and drop food everywhere because they're exhausted and they're the parents. That's the hardest. That's hardest for the parents to teach in this kind of situation. But in this scene, Anne Sullivan is not going to give up on her. She's going to sit at that table. She's going to finish her dinner. And the scene is crazy. So she's pushing her down. She's getting up. Things are flying off the table. It's complete and insane chaos. And food's being hurled everywhere. And Danny, at this point, was starting to write in sentences. And I said, what? And then at the end, she sits down. Her teacher's bun is all messy. And it's chaotic. But she finishes her meal. And they're both kind of angry with each other. And then I asked Danny, I said, what did you think about that scene? And he said, it's interesting because it looks violent, but there's no violence, only love. And I was like, this is a kid that could barely say like one word, you know, and now he's saying these long, complicated, beautiful, poetic thoughts. And it was like so exciting. So I was in the middle of that with Danny and my career was launching off and I felt like I can't leave him at this very critical space, you know, but I ended up sort of slowly easing out while other teachers came in, and he ended up doing great. I mean, he went to Harvard with an attendant helping him, but he's really a brilliant kid. And it was so satisfying to see that little, you know, you never know. You're like, am I projecting all these complicated thoughts I think he's having onto him? What's mine? What's his? So being able to hear him say that about that movie was amazing. Cause I was like, I didn't imagine it. Like what a beautiful, lovely, complicated insight. And it was from him.
I'm so glad I asked that question. It's interesting with the you know, adaptive and special needs communities. As firefighters, we don't get any training, you know. So you have, you know, a police officer that will grab someone with autism, or you know, you'll run on a person with Down syndrome, not realize that their pain tolerance is, you know, 10 times what a regular person would be.
Yeah, there's all these like sensory issues. I love Danny. I get emotional whenever I talk about him. But there's all these like sensory issues that you wouldn't be aware of too that are going on too. And like they're so trapped inside their own bodies, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, then, so we're going back to the comedy. One of the things I used to do when I was in university in London was go to the Comedy Store. It was and I'd just go on my own. I call it master dating. You just take yourself out. But it was just, I mean, I absolutely loved it. So you transitioned from, you know, like you said, laundrettes and smoky bars. Where for a comedian were the best places for the live shows ultimately?
For me, it's different for every comic. It doesn't really matter the city as much. I do like New York crowds. I like crowds I've had some good crowds in Texas, Austin. It's been fun. But the most important thing to me, I find, is Lafayette, Louisiana. I had one of the best shows of my life recently. They were great. It was like a lot of very small factors, a low ceiling where they kind of feel intimate. Even a place I tape my special, Sony Hall, they have a lower ceiling, even though it kind of looks, it's a larger room. It's still, there's an intimacy to the room. And same with the other place I shot my special, John Jay. So I find that if there's like a low ceiling, the acoustics are good. You're not too separated from your audience. For me, that's great. But you know, you never know. There's like a weird little third element that can be kind of magical when you're on the road. And just, I find that it definitely doesn't have to do with East Coast or West Coast. And I do find that most people are pretty laid back as audience members. The uptightness, the stuff people talk about like overly woke culture, people that are offended by everything, that I see more evidence of that online. But I travel all over the world. When I play for real people and real audiences, they don't really give a fuck. They just want to laugh and they don't care. So I feel like that's a lot of things that's happening more, I think, online in the comment sections. But real, like, working class people, they don't care. They don't get too offended too easily. They're pretty cool.
I say the same thing about kindness. You know, you watch the TV, you watch your doom and gloom, you know, choices on social media. They'll convince you that we all hate each other, that we, you know, the blacks are against the whites and the, you know, the straights are against the gays. And then you walk out your front door and you're like, wait a second, there's not a race war going on. And I know people of all colors and creeds that their kids play together and they talk when they're walking their dogs. So where is this? And of course it exists, but it's a small section of society that's projecting itself on the rest of us.
I agree. Yeah. I don't think that you can learn what our societal problems are from like a Instagram, because they'll tell you that we're more divided than we've ever been, and that, you know, there's no common ground, and, or somebody will, if you don't think this way, then, you know, you're cruel. And if you don't agree, whatever, all that shit, I see more online. Real people, they don't give a fuck, and they're tired and they want to laugh, and they're, and like, that's what's cool about stand-up is like you talk some shit about what you've been through and hopefully make some fun of yourself and all your own weird, you know, failures and mistakes, and somebody gets some sort of relief and you find some common ground. And I don't find that I've rarely had people in shows freaking out about a word choice or, yeah, or anything like that. And certainly firefighters, because now my crowd is about half firefighters and they don't give a shit. So people in the comment section will be like, can you believe that she's saying these things about her hero husband? And, you know, so sometimes people will get offended on behalf of firefighters. But from my personal experience, and I cannot speak for firefighters as a general group, they don't really give a fuck. Like, you're not going to say a lot to like rattle somebody that hurls their body into burning buildings. They're not going to be like pissed off because I made some dumb joke about them. They don't care. They're the best laughers, like firefighter families, and they're coming out like crazy now. So I'm like grateful that they have a sense of humor, and that's probably a lot of what works in the marriage between my husband and me, is like, you know, he infuriates me in a variety of ways that I detail on stage, but he can definitely take a joke.
Yeah, no, firehouse humor is amazing. And if you're talking about being offended, if they put cameras inside fire stations, the world would lose their mind.
Yeah, we always joke about that because it's like the Comedy Cellar table. You know, like when a normal person comes over, we always call them a civilian. Ugh, so-and-so brought his like civilian girlfriend to the table last night. Like, because comics just want to be deep animal pigs and say unspeakable shit to each other. But I've heard that it's kind of similar at the firehouse. I know even when I walked in, before they even knew me as a comedian or anybody knew what I did, and I was just Pete's appendage, which I still am many of places that he's working. You could feel the chemicals change in the room. And when a person that's not a firefighter walks up to that table, and it's the same feeling at the Comedy Cellar when some normal person comes up and we feel like we can't say unspeakable, insane shit to each other. So I definitely am grateful that that's kind of been the attitude I've gotten from firefighter families. And I'm sure that somebody will watch this special and get offended by some shit or tell me that I'm wrong for saying this or that or whatever. And I'm sure I'll get comments and emails and, you know, fuck it. That's their right.
What were some of the biggest misconceptions that you had about the fire service or firefighters that suddenly got debunked when you started dating one?
Well, I didn't know how much they love the fires and just hurling their bodies into fires. I mean, 'cause I figured it would be kind of like they enjoyed it, but also maybe be more of a hassle. I didn't know how much rivalry there was and shit talk about when you don't get fires, we're not in a good neighborhood when you catch a lot of fires. So my husband is like, yeah, that's like shit you could talk between firefighters if somebody's in some neighborhood where they don't get enough good jobs. So I didn't realize how much they love the fires. And I didn't realize how much other weird, annoying shit they have to do. So like, I didn't know that like that was the person that's going to like, you know, pull a fat guy out of a bathtub or something. I'm like, oh, okay. That's a firefighter. All right. I didn't know how many stuck elevators were involved. This might just be FDNY. I don't know, but there's a lot of stuck elevators. By the way, if you are afraid of being stuck in an elevator, it happens like 7 times a day. So just hang out, like, I don't know, like buy something on ASOS. It doesn't matter. They're going to be there in like 15 minutes. He's always getting somebody out of an elevator. I don't know how many car accidents they go to. And so there's in New York, it's like, you know, car accidents, stuck elevators, overdoses, like so much other shit. You know, like if you have a seizure, there's going to be a fireman in shorts that you're going to see first. All right. And then the medics will come. But first, you're just going to be looking at a fireman. If you're coming out of a seizure and there's a guy there in blue shorts and you're in New York, it'll be cold. The medics will be there in like 2 minutes. Yeah. And here in New York, so every fire department is different from city to city. But in New York, so some places, the EMT is a separate department. And in New York, P will say we do the ABCs, airway, breathing, and circulation. So they come for like kind of stabilizing people. But where they want to be is deep inside a fire. My husband told me when he became chief that he wouldn't go into fires anymore. He lied. He was immediately in a fire within like 2 weeks. So this big supermarket fire in Bushwick. And he came home and he's like, oh, it was awesome. I got to knock down all these walls. It was awesome. Gorgeous fucking tinderbox. They get upset too when somebody else gets their job. There's like, oh, I just thought it was whoever got there first. No, that was our fucking job. Read the ticket. So it's like this rig cut, this rig got, like there's all this weird shit that I had no idea about that is hilarious and fascinating to me. But there's a lot of politics around FOIAs. And I didn't know how much cake was involved. Because in New York, if you want a promotion, you got to bring a cake. There's cakes involved too in England. It's cakes everywhere.
Well, I'm a firefighter in America. I was a firefighter paramedic for 14 years. So every time...
Where? You get your, what city? I didn't know that.
So I worked initially in the Miami area, a place called Hialeah, then Anaheim, California for a few years, and then around the Orlando area for the last 10. And so, Hialeah, like it was first everything, you had to buy cake. First fire, buy cake. First extrication, buy cake. And you're a poor, brand new firefighter.
So the cake thing is everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. So everything is communicated through cakes, you guys. You want a promotion, you get a fucking pie. And their different cakes mean different things. Oh, so-and-so, you know, grandma died, you got to get him a sponge cake. This guy's wife cheated on him, you know, you got to get him an apple pie, like whatever. There's different fucking cakes for different occasions, and I'm always getting a cake. I'm always in a car with my husband getting a cake to bring to, like, to some local commander. You bring your wife, you clean up nice, and you bring a fucking cake. Everything is cakes! Why?
And what about the infusion of what you were experiencing as a firefighter, you know, girlfriend, ultimately spouse, into your actual material for your comedy?
Honestly, it happened pretty quick. I was like, there's a lot here. If I'm going to squeeze a Netflix special out of anybody, it's going to be using my husband's job. I'm pretty fast. It was funny. I was like, this is crazy. First of all, just his accent alone. Like, I have a joke about it. Like, they say FOIA FOIDA, FIYAFIDA. And I'm like, it sounds like a little kid trying to say what his daddy does. Like, my daddy's a FOIA FOIDA. And I'm like, I met his brother has no accent. I'm like, Pete, like, why do you speak like this? His brother's like, oh, it's the firehouse. So it's like, he has one of the thicker accents I've heard. I can't tell if it's getting softer or I'm more used to it, but his brother has no accent whatsoever. So I didn't realize that either. And then just like now Pete bought a house with Bitcoin. They all love crypto here. So there's always like some fireman here fixing something in our house. And I'm like, Anthony is not a plumber, but he is. And I'm like, there's a reason he's pacing outside smoking when we're getting an inspection, because he doesn't want to fucking his captain to fail his inspection. He can't. He's like, I'm going to mess up the plumbing in my cap's house. And then I'm like, Pete, don't you think that's not a good sign that he's pacing outside because he's not a plumber? Can we please hire? It's like the mafia. Everything's inside the fire department. You got to hire inside. Everybody's got a guy. Everybody's got a guy. And nothing gets finished because they've always got another 24. So it's like, when is this going to, like, Pete gutted the house while I was living inside of it. I almost lost my mind. Just pulled the walls off our house. And I was like, oh, he's like, we're going to re-insulate the house. And I'm like, re-insulate what? Like, when? Thursday? Like, I don't know. I'm like a Jew from Bethesda. And then he explained later that, like, re-insulating means gutting a house. I was like, oh, and where am I going to be? He's like, here, upstairs. And that's what happened. Just four firemen just ripped out my house and rebuilt it while I was living in it with a two-year-old. And I still have like a twitch because of that.
Are there any other comedians that talk about the fire service specifically, or was this kind of new material that you brought to the world of comedy?
I'm sure there are. There was one woman I met her name was Christine. I got to remember her last name. Anyway, there's got to be another comedian that talks about, I know there is at least one that was married to a firefighter. I think she's a Boston comic. I can't remember her last name. She's hysterical and lovely. And I'm going to remember later and message it to you. But she told me that I worked with her once and she told me she was married to a firefighter. And I saw her stand up that day on the show and it was really good. But I don't think it's that common. There's not a lot of comedians it's firefighter marriages that I know of. Well, comment below.
Well, another interesting parallel when I talked to a lot of the people in comedy was some of the mental health struggles they saw in their own profession. And we're obviously aware of comics that we've lost through to, you know, addiction and some other things. And then, you know, my profession, it's the same thing. Now, arguably, there are some similarities, probably, you know, childhood trauma on both sides, kind of messed up hours when it comes to sleep deprivation conversation. What have you observed in your profession specifically about that element?
There is a lot of mental health issues with comics. Yeah. I mean, we're not well. There's a reason we need to like hold a room full of people. We basically hijack a room so that people will listen to our points that we need to make. We're definitely not people that were listened to. Nobody heard me out early on. Otherwise, wouldn't need to like hijack strangers to make sure I got a word in. People that felt misunderstood. People that needed people to understand something they didn't understand. People that couldn't let go. People pleasers. All kinds of stuff.
Now, with that, building on that, so Big Guy is the latest special that you've got. Obviously, that's just being released on Netflix this week. Is there a sense of satisfaction or, you know, because some people obviously they chase and chase and chase and feel fulfilled, unfulfilled constantly. Was there a point where you started kind of feeling that it was being nurtured of some of the elements that you struggled with when you were younger?
Definitely this last year on the road, seeing these like firefighter families come out, it's been very cool. A lot of the guys bring me their challenge coins, bring me gifts, t-shirts, just for what? Like telling some jokes, saying twat a couple times. I mean, I don't deserve these gifts. It's very moving. They're lovely to my whole family. They've done all kinds of wonderful stuff for us. Also, there's a foundation that I work with here called Friends of Firefighters, and they offer free therapy and mental health services to all of FDNY. FDNY, all you can get therapy through the fire department itself, but sometimes the guys don't feel comfortable doing it that way, and they want to do it outside of the job. And this offers therapy also to their entire family. It's completely free. Friends of Firefighters, it's in downtown Brooklyn. So I do stuff with them. But this last year, just seeing how many people came out was pretty cool. And seeing that like this hour, I feel like it's getting through to more people. I don't know why, but it feels good. Will I be able to hold on to it? Probably not. I'll read some dumb comment from some guy on YouTube that'll get in my head and I'll develop some new physical insecurity. But today, feels good.
I had Nancy Carbone on the show a couple of times talking about Friends of Firefighters.
Yes, I love Nancy. Nancy's a good friend of mine. You know, we have wine here in Queens and hang out. And yeah, she's incredible. I love Nancy. Yeah, and the cool thing is she's done, Nancy, is that she has firefighters and in her building, and it's built in she has her mental health building is in an old firehouse that's inoperative. So the guys feel at home. It feels like their firehouse kitchen, and there's a lot of firefighters that work with them and do other programs too, and suicide prevention programs. And she just knows how to make it feel like a good hang and not to feel weird. And make everybody comfortable. And she listens to like what it's going to take to do that. She's very smart.
Well, I love the fact as well, they have a lot of retirees working there. So now, you know, because I think that's the population that we kind of have failed a little bit. You know, the door comes down on your last shift and a lot of people, that's it. And certainly in the departments I've worked for, there's no health insurance. You know, there's nothing. You're done. And there's no VA for firefighters. You know, there's no one taking care of you after beating yourself up for 20, 30 years. So to bring our retirees back in and give them a sense of purpose and make them feel like they're still in the tribe, I think is very important.
Very important, because that's your whole world forever. Like if I had to stop doing stand-up, I would be unwell. I'd just be rocking in a window, like chain smoking, glaring at strangers. I would not be okay. They need to do something. That's the other thing that I realized about firefighters. They're not still ever. My husband is always like just spraying some spot in the lawn. Like he can't sit down. He's always doing something that doesn't need to be done. Just like repainting some piece of furniture, some confusing, heinous color, just because he can't be still. And it's like that when you retire because you don't have the kitchen table. Yeah. A little jittery. We are too. I get that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one more area and then we'll make sure everyone knows where to find Big Guy. When it comes to the performers, so the singers, the comedians that I had on the show, one area that seems very apparent, even though there's an element of fame and obviously the financial part, it seems like a lot of people don't enjoy the actual touring element, the being away from the family. What is that kind of experience so far with you in comedy?
It's very hard for me. A lot of times I bring Pete and Frankie, my daughter, and we all go together as a family, but it's really confusing to juggle it all between his 24-hour shifts and my schedule and to figure it all out. So I'm really praying that with this special, I can get to the place where I can afford to bring a nanny in case Pete's on the job so that I don't have to trust a babysitter that I don't know in a weird city when I'm on stage and I don't have to be away from my daughter. I'm away only usually 2 days at a time, like Thursday, Friday, or Thursday, Friday, Saturday. But I try to bring them every time I can. And I don't want to have to go away for another long weekend without her. And she loves it when she comes. Like, she loves the hotels. She has a blast, piece into it, because, you know, your job is like, it's like unexpected weird things being hurled at you. He always says he's going to write a book about the Fireman's Review of Green Rooms. I'm like, I think there's a real supply and demand issue with that book, but he's going to be like, yeah, I'll do like a firefighter's review of every green room in this country. It's a good coffee table book. So he loves the green room and like hanging out, and comics like firefighters because it's like, there's no crossover. They don't want anything the other one has, you know, they're great laughers. And, you know, most comics I know are not, they're not trying to do anything a firefighter's trying to do. So they get on pretty well. It's a good hang.
So Big Guy is on Netflix. Where else can people find your other work? And are there any websites or social media handles to point people to as well?
Rachel Feinstein _ my page, Rachel Feinstein, is a punch up. If you go to Punch Up Live, I have a page there. A lot of comedians have a page there with my tour dates, also at rachel-feinstein.com. And what else? Let me see here. I guess that's it. Sorry. You can edit that and make it condense it. I'm getting like messages that are distracting me, but, rachel-feinstein.com, rachel-feinstein_. You could go to my, other touring page, which is linked on my Instagram and Facebook, and, watch the special Big Guy. It's streaming now on Netflix. I think it's in the top 5 today.
Beautiful.
So I'm excited.
Well, I want to thank you so much. I know you've been pulled from 1,000 directions because of the release. So thank you so much for carving out an hour and taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you. I had the best time. I can't wait to do it again.